This is Dr. Richard Verone. I'm conducting an oral history interview with Mr. John McNown, Jr. Today is September 16th, 2003. It's approximately 8:44 a.m. Central Standard Time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library interview room on the campus of Texas Tech University. And Mr. McNown, you're in Overland Park, Kansas?
Actually, I'm in Mission, Kansas. Okay. I work in Mission, Kansas, right.
Okay, very good. Let's start with the biographical sketch of yourself, sir. Could you tell me when and where you were born and a little bit about your childhood?
Yes, I was born in, I guess, on Keesler Field, Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
My father was in the Army Air Corps at the time. He was a career officer. Actually, he bounced back and forth. He was riffed a couple of times. He started off as a private. I think he joined the Army in 1940, went to OCS in 42, and I was born March 1st, 1944. So I grew up on military posts, on Air Force bases. My father was a, most of his career was a provost marshal. He was an air police officer.
Mm-hmm.
And we spent time in Germany and Japan and Hawaii and a lot of time in Texas. There's a lot of Air Force bases
mm-hmm.
in Texas.
Yes, sir.
And I thought I was a Texan for a long time. I used to brainwash you pretty well when you were in schools back there.
Yes, sir.
And I think I went to 12 schools in 13 years, if you count kindergarten.
Wow.
Started off kindergarten in Germany. My dad was stationed, in Marburg, Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of an interesting situation there. He was the only Air Force officer in a supply post. And he was a first lieutenant. We were living in this huge house because the Air Force at the time was very had just become its own branch of the armed forces.
Mm-hmm.
And they were insisting that their senior officers got the same quarters as the Army senior officer on the post, and he was a general. So
mm-hmm.
The entire Air Force detachment actually lived in his house with my dad instead of in the barracks. So we had kind of an interesting group setting
mm-hmm.
while we were in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And then various posts around the world. We were in Japan in 1953 when I was in fourth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And that was pretty interesting because we used to have air raid drills and we'd have to go out and get in foxholes in the schoolyard because they were at the time they were still worried that the Chinese might decide to come into the war bigger and bomb Japan. So,
right.
So I had kind of an interesting childhood as far as moving around and doing a lot of things.
How long were you in Japan?
Just a year.
Okay.
We were there for a year. Lived off post for about the first 3 or 4 months. They didn't have enough quarters there, and so we lived out sort of on the economy in a small village called Kogane,
mm-hmm.
and all my playmates and things were Japanese. I didn't speak any Japanese, but
mm-hmm.
A lot of kids my age around there, and that was actually a very nice experience for me. It
mm-hmm.
was a good thing that, you know, they were playing baseball even back then, so we had something in common and got to be friends with a lot of young Japanese people. Of course, I didn't keep in touch with them. When you're in fourth grade, when you come home, you don't
right.
think about pen pals and things as much.
Right.
So we spent, and then actually graduated from Waipahu High School in Waipahu, Hawaii. I only
mm-hmm.
endured 3 months, so I've never been invited to a reunion. But I don't think they know I actually went to school there. It was sort of interesting moving around.
So you bounced around quite a bit. How do you
yeah.
think that's affected you? Did it was it a positive experience overall, do you think?
Actually, I think it was. I think it gives you a fairly cosmopolitan outlook on how things are and how things work. And
mm-hmm.
and Air Force bases especially are like small communities because they're usually much smaller than an Army post.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think you get sort of that small town, close knit feeling there. And I always saw it sort of because we moved so much, I guess, as sort of an adventure. There was someplace new to go, someplace new to see.
Right.
And it made friends fairly easily, I think, at that time. And so it was always a good experience for us. We always lived on post because of my dad's occupation, and therefore you didn't have some of the problems that I know my sisters had a little later on when after I had graduated from high school, they moved to a couple places and actually lived down in the civilian economy.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you weren't accepted as readily out there because people had, you know, they lived there their entire lives. And
right.
Whereas on the Air Force bases, people were moving all the time, and so you just, you know, sort of made new friends as they appeared.
Mm-hmm. I imagine that the ability for you to make those new friends has helped you throughout your career and in your life after that. After you graduated and gotten out, I would imagine, I've heard this from a number of people who've moved around on military bases, that if they were able to adapt like that to those changing situations, that transferred into their adult life as well.
I think it's been good in my professional life. I think I'm a little more introverted, and I'm not sure why that is in my private life, and so it hasn't. I'm not a real network kind of person when I'm out, you know, outside the house.
Right.
I mean, outside of work, and so from that standpoint, it's been a little different. But but it's been fine in work because I can sort of integrate in fairly rapidly into a setting.
Tell me about your schooling. How were you as a student?
I was a good student. A's and B's all through high school, and sort of an indifferent student by the time I got to college. I'm not quite sure why that was, but really enjoyed school. I was blessed with having some very good teachers, I think, when I was in Texas, especially fifth, sixth grade, and in my junior and senior year in high school, it really, I think, you know, teachers make a lot of difference. They can say what they want about school systems, and I think the thing that makes a person learn or have the desire to learn is whether they get a good teacher or not.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And so I just feel like I received an excellent education at a time when the Texas school systems weren't reputed to be very, you know, very good, and that carried on with me. All through life, I've always had a fairly easy time in school, and unfortunately, that, you know, I didn't have the self discipline maybe in college on some things I got through, but had the desire. I wanted to be an Army officer. That's what I wanted to do, and so, you know, going to college was just a method to that end.
Right. How about sports? Were you athletic?
Played a little football in junior high, and then because we transferred every year, they had a transfer rule in Texas, and so I wasn't actually eligible. The only thing I was interested in was football, and three out of my 4 years, because I'd started practicing someplace, I wasn't actually eligible to play, and of course, by the time I got to be, you know, a senior, it was pretty much over, so no.
Okay.
That's a long answer I was reasonably athletic, but didn't play.
Mm-hmm. Your father was in the military. Obviously, we've talked about that. Any other relatives that was in the military?
Yeah, I have an uncle who was a career NCO in the Air Force, and he actually lives in San Antonio now. He retired as the non-commissioned officer in charge of the radio crypto school for the Air Force. He was in radios for years, and actually a pretty brilliant man in his own right. He used to put the planes together that used to spy on you know, over in Southeast Asia. Would actually configure them and talk to the vendors about what they were going to put inside the planes to do what. And it just grew up with radios and was awfully good at it. And then I have my other uncle on my mother's side was a career Air Force officer, and he retired as a lieutenant colonel, went in during World War II and then stayed in. And my father's only brother actually built airplanes for McDonnell Douglas in the 40s all the way till he retired in 1979. So even though he was 4F for the draft in World War II, had a heart murmur, he had something to do with the military his whole life. So.
Okay. I can only imagine that with your father in the military and then these others, that this was a huge influence on you joining the military.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I knew, and I liked it, and I felt that that was what I wanted to do. I knew I didn't want to be in the Air Force, because in the Air Force, it becomes pretty obvious that if you're not rated, as they say, you know, not a pilot, mm-hmm. that it sort of limits what you could do, or at least at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided that I really would rather be in the Army, and always kind of wanted to be an infantry soldier. I have no idea why. I was a history major, and I guess I read too much history. But part of the reason was I thought, you know, there would be a better chance for promotion and advancement in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
Because my eyes were bad enough I wasn't going to be able to fly.
Right. How did your parents feel about you joining the military?
Oh, they were very much in favor of it. They thought it was a good life and felt that that was, you know, if that's what I wanted to do, they were very much in favor of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Didn't actually push me into that, though. So.
Right. That was your decision.
Right.
Okay. What year did you graduate high school in Hawaii?
1962.
Okay. And what were your plans after that? Were you expected to go to college? Did you want to go to college?
Little bit of both. I think my parents wanted me to go to college. I wanted to be, I wanted to be an officer in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there was three ways to do that. OCS wasn't very big at the time. Matter of mm-hmm. fact, it was, I think, pretty small at times. So there wasn't many people going into that. I applied and did an application at West Point, was first alternate here in Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I thought about it, I decided I didn't want to go someplace where it wasn't girls.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up deciding to go the college route through ROTC.
Okay. And where did you go?
Went a year to the University of Hawaii. And mm-hmm. so I ended up 5 years in school at a time when people were graduating in three, because my first year was pretty much wasted, but I had a great time.
Mm-hmm.
And ended up going to Southwest Missouri State in Springfield. My parents were over in Hawaii, and they wanted me to be somewhere close to family, and I had grandparents in Bolivar, Missouri. Mm-hmm. And we'd gone around and looked at some places, and I wasn't as much interested in where I went to school as what the outcome was going to be when I came out, and they had a very good ROTC program, actually.
Okay. So you were there at Southwest Missouri State from 63 until...
67, graduated
okay.
in 67.
Okay. Tell me about your college years here. What are your memories, your main memories of that?
Let me see. I had a great experience in college. I loved the social experience. I loved a lot of the learning experience.
Mm-hmm.
I was a resident assistant in a dorm for 3 years, and so that certainly helped matters as far as, you know, it paid for my room and board for the last 3 years I was in school.
Mm-hmm.
And between that and the summer, at that time you could make tuition and books, and ROTC gave me enough spending money to get by. I didn't have a car, so you didn't have a lot of expenses that way.
Mm-hmm.
And was in the student senate, did a lot of different things while I was in school. Had a lot of good friends, and I still have from college.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a very positive experience. I just enjoyed the entire spectrum of college life. And sometimes I enjoyed going to class, and sometimes I didn't. So.
Mm-hmm. You indicated earlier that you were an average, a little bit better than average student.
Mm-hmm. I unfortunately would get upset and not drop a class. I would quit going but not drop it, and that lowers your grade point considerably.
Yes, sir.
On occasion. So, mm-hmm. But did really well in ROTC. Did really well in my major. I was a history major with a political science minor.
Mm-hmm.
And probably have enough hours in English to get a minor in that if I would have applied for one or mm-hmm. you know, declared it. And had a wonderful time in the classes I enjoyed and the classes I didn't enjoy. I kind of skated through. So
mm-hmm. Tell me about ROTC. What was that like?
ROTC at Southwest Missouri State was actually pretty. It was a great experience. We had good instructors, and at one time, SMS had graduated more general officers than as a percentage than any school in the country.
Wow!
And I think I'm not sure that they still have that distinction, but one time even higher than A&M and pretty close to West Point. They had a class in '63, I think, of 19 or 20 graduates, and 30% of them became general officers. They just had a. I guess probably we had one really distinguished class, and then there was the rest of us. Really good. Matter of fact, I was very much influenced in my entire military career by a man named Major George Urish, who had been a platoon leader in the Korean War, and was just an excellent instructor, and just I suspect he'd been a really good leader as a platoon leader and a company commander. He just had kind of an aura about him, and he liked me, and I liked him, and I learned an awful lot from him that they don't teach in the books, which is an important thing after you get in combat. There's a lot of things they teach you that really just don't work as well as they think they're going to. And he taught me the best lesson I ever had from anyone as far as military training was, and that was the whatever unit you command is the smallest unit you take any place with you. So if you're a squad leader, you take your whole squad. You never split it. If you're a platoon leader, you take your whole platoon. If you're a company commander, you take your whole company, whether it's one sniper or a whole battalion. And it was a good lesson. It's something they don't teach in military training, but something he learned in Korea. So,
Okay, and you've taken that. You took that with you during your military career?
Yes.
Did it serve you well in Vietnam?
Yes, it did.
Okay.
Yes, it did. Or at least I feel it did. So.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about the climate there at Southwest Missouri State in the 1960s. There's a lot of stuff going on internationally and domestically, and I'm really curious about how much the U.S. involvement in Southeast Asia was discussed in your history classes and political science classes?
Actually, because I graduated in '67, I think the war was still seen as a fairly positive thing at that time. And Springfield, Missouri, being a conservative community and sort of right in the center of the country, a lot of the activism hadn't gotten down there by the time I graduated. So.
Right.
There was some concern, I think, by the time I graduated, about my last semester, about what was going on, because the draft had certainly picked up some momentum by the first part of '67. But prior to that, and of course, it was discussed a lot in the ROTC classes, just because by '67 they were telling us, everybody was going to Vietnam, that graduated. And so there was a lot of discussion about it there, but again, it was sort of, this is what we do, and this is the job, and this is where you're going to go, and we're going to train you the best we can. So,
how did you feel about it personally? Do you remember?
Actually, when you're young and dumb, I guess, as far as that kind of thing goes, I was actually worried that they were going to get the war over before I got there, because at that time there was certainly a lot of talk about, well, we're winning, things are going very well, and I thought, well, this may be my only chance, to go over and actually see combat. At the time, I thought that if you're going to be a soldier, you should go over and see combat, and I thought, well, there may or may not, it may or may not be over by the time I have a chance to be there, so.
Right.
So that was one thought, and of course, you always worry about, well, once I get there, how am I really going to perform? So, I mean, that was mainly my two main thoughts about it.
Did you have an idea of why the United States was in Vietnam at the time?
Well, I actually believe that, and in retrospect, I think it may have been true that we were over there to stop communism from expanding, and I think that. As you get older and you put things in perspective, I suspect it was just all part of the Truman Doctrine, if you want to call it that. and that it was probably maybe the right thing to do. It seemed the right thing to do at the time. We were over there protecting the people, and the only thing that seemed a little strange about it was the South Vietnamese government certainly wasn't even, you know, in 60, by 65, 66, you know, they were having all this turmoil, you know, the coups about every other month, it seemed like, for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And that it didn't seem like there was much stability there. But I actually did buy into the fact that, you know, that the domino theory might be correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you get the feeling that other people around you, especially in ROTC, felt the same way?
Pretty much. And of course, we had people that you know, at the campus, but they weren't very vocal there at the time, that felt the opposite. That, you know, they just couldn't figure out. I had a good friend, Cliff at the time, and I'm blanking on his last name right now, but, he was gonna stay in school for as long as he could because he didn't want to go over there. Mm-hmm. And we were good friends, and he just felt that there wasn't anything over there for him, and he didn't want anything to do with it. He felt that we didn't know what we were doing, should stay out.
Mm-hmm. How did you adapt to the military kind of training and lifestyle in ROTC? And then, as we get into your basic training, how did you adapt to all that? You've grown up around it.
Yeah, pretty well, but one of the things I learned is, as I went through life, and it was coming out then, I don't particularly take orders well, which is not that's probably one reason I'm still not in the service. If somebody gives me a good reason to do something and it seems to make sense in the context that you're doing it and the right thing to do, I felt I would follow that kind of a person just about any place. If somebody just told me I should be doing this because they told me to do it, then I have a tendency to pretty much ignore that. I first came across that a little bit in ROTC. We had lieutenant colonel there who as I remember, he was a transportation officer, and he was pretty much thought that he was a lieutenant colonel, and that was an important thing to be, and that that we should just do something when we were in ROTC because he told us to do that. Mm-hmm. And I later found out from the sergeant major there that the reason I didn't make distinguished military graduate was because this particular person put a letter in my file, and I didn't realize it, saying that I was not good military material because that I had questioned orders.
Hmm. Okay.
And so maybe he had some insight that I didn't realize at the time. So.
Looking back, do you know why you were like that?
Yeah, maybe my dad, as I said, was he'd been a squadron commander and a provost marshal his whole life, and so you pretty much had to toe the line because part of, you know, what he taught me was that, you know, I wasn't allowed to get into trouble as I was a teenager because it reflected on him and his job, and certainly I have a lot of love and respect for my father, and I did that, so I didn't have much rebelliousness in me. Or it wasn't allowed much when I was growing up in my youth, and so I think by the time I got into college, I had the ability to exercise whether I wanted to do something or not, which wasn't really allowed at home, and I think I just decide on my own. If I decide, then, you know, that makes sense to me, I'll do it, or if it doesn't, I'm not going to do it. Mm-hmm. So I think that's pretty much where that comes from.
Okay. So when you graduated in 1967, you were off to Fort Benning, is that correct?
Right.
And did you have the summer there off before you had to report, or were you there?
I reported probably about the 25th of July. I'm not sure. It was toward the end of July. And so I had, we graduated, I think, around the 16th or 18th of May, so I had a couple of months off before I went down.
Okay.
And had a great time during the summer before I went down, and worked a little bit and partied a lot. And and went off to Fort Benning.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about Fort Benning. What was it like? This was your Combat Platoon Leaders course.
Right. Well, let me see. Fort Benning was just a huge going concern by then. The OCS classes, they were graduating one a week or something. I mean, just a huge number of OCS people going mm-hmm. through school down there. The airborne school, in the summer was full of people, running around. That was the first year they made the West Pointers go to infantry officer basic, or as they called it at the time, combat platoon leaders course.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had all the West Point graduating class was down there that were going infantry. And they just had a class starting, it seemed like one or two a week coming out of ROTC.
Mm-hmm.
Seemed to me like there was like nine classes or something going through at the same time we were. We were the second class for what they called 68. So they must have started the 1st of July. So it looked like they were starting about two a month. And you'd have 200 people about in a class. And we were, we were living in basically what were BOQs. They weren't mm-hmm. exactly like a barracks. We'd have two guys to a room. And we had an administrative company commander, administrative platoon leaders, and some people. And it was about a nine-week course at the time, and it was all strictly focused on being a platoon leader
mm-hmm.
and not much on administration or anything else that you needed later in life. So,
what was your typical day like there?
You'd get up about 4:30 or so in the morning. We'd come out, have formation. We'd have breakfast. We'd do some PT, run around, and then we would have either field training or class training down in Infantry Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And that ran pretty much 6 days a week, and we would be off Sunday most of the time. We even ran through a couple of Sundays, as I remember.
Mm-hmm.
I remember we worked, we trained on Labor Day, so we didn't get the holiday off. They were pushing people through just about as fast as they could possibly push them.
Mm-hmm.
The thing I remember about Fort Benning is just the excellence of the instructors there.
Mm-hmm.
Just incredibly good instructors in almost every class. And of course, they were all specially picked, and they were allowed to spend 6 months preparing their class. A lot of things a lot of teachers would like to be able to do, and they might only teach one class during the week, but they, of course, they taught it over and over again, and there was pretty much an unlimited expense account for what they needed to make the class interesting, exciting, and memorable, so people would take it with them. I remember we had a guy that had him build a concrete ramp right into Infantry Hall into one of the stages so they could run a tank up right into the classroom. They'd have the curtain shut, and he said, "Gentlemen, I present armor in the attack," and all of a sudden this tank just roars from outside into the classroom, and they'd spend, I guess, lots of money reinforcing the stage so it would hold a tank.
Mm-hmm. That certainly would make an impression.
Yeah, well, I did. No question about it. I mean, and so there was just class after class that was just incredibly well taught, and the visuals were, I guess they had a whole battalion just making mock-ups and things for people. So like on an M60 machine gun, they'd have a mock-up that was probably 8 feet long that you could bought that actually was made out of wood but had all the parts carved and working and things. A lot of expense, and I know a lot of, they told us that a lot of colleges were sending their education departments down to look to see what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Our particular administrative platoon leader, who had been a alert platoon leader with the 173rd Airborne, I think, over, and then had was the first lieutenant about to make captain, and he had been chosen to teach a class. And one of the things he was doing while he was working on his lesson plan, then he'd be the administrative platoon leader for one of the ROTC classes.
Mm-hmm.
And he was telling us that he had 6 months to prepare this, and then he, or 3 months, I guess, to start it off, and he'd go in and make a pitch to a committee. They'd critique it. They'd come back a month later, present the class again, and then after 6 months, he would start doing, he would actually start teaching the class,
mm-hmm.
and he would teach it for 6 months, and then he would start transitioning out. And so it was pretty much, it seemed like a year or two of duty, or maybe it was 18 months. I mean, he may have taught it for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would rotate him out into someplace else.
Okay. Did you split your time between the classroom and out in the field training?
Yes. And so some days we would be mostly down at Infantry Hall, which was just a huge place. I don't know how many classrooms it had, but we would spend a lot of the time in there. And some days you'd go out. You do some field training where you didn't maybe actually go out and get real muddy or anything, but you'd be out, doing rifle firing or something
mm-hmm.
in the afternoon and have class in the daytime. And then sometimes you would go out to the field, you know, be out for 3-4 days
mm-hmm.
at a time when you'd have some exercises. One of the interesting things that happened to us, that John Wayne was there filming the Green Berets while we were going through class.
Yes, sir.
And I suppose one of the memorable things that was sort of funny was we were supposed to get helicopter training. That was a big deal. They were going to, you know, teach us so we could read maps from a helicopter. And we were standing out in this huge field in our little U-shapes waiting for the helicopters to come in. And we heard all these trucks starting up off in the woods, and the trucks pulled into our little U-shapes, and on the side it said helicopters. And so that was our helicopter training, because he had all the helicopters.
How interesting.
Making the movie. So we never got, I was never on a helicopter until I got to Vietnam. It was
wow.
Kind of, so that was pretty exciting for me, the first time I got a helicopter trip. I'd been looking
right.
forward for it for a year.
Your instructors, were they Vietnam veterans?
A lot of them were, yeah. I would say over 50% of them were.
Mm-hmm.
They'd come back, and they were usually, you know, what they used to call 5 percenters. They were the people at the top of their class, but they were also people that they thought would be good, you know, had a little bit of flair for teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them had, you know, I remember... one of them to this day, the fellow that taught us on Labor Day, his name was Captain Marbert, and he had such a great pitch that I even remember his name 30 years later. It was the company in the attack, and he was out, they called him Garbage Mouth Marbert, and they claimed his pitch was so dirty they wouldn't let him give it in Infantry Hall because they were afraid a congressman or somebody would come in. But he had a giant playmate that had been blown up, I don't know, it was probably 10 feet long and 3 feet tall, a centerfold, and had it intersected with grid lines and things, and kept talking about various objectives and stuff,
mm-hmm.
and it was just a really wonderful pitch for a group of young men, because it kept your attention during the whole day. And
yes,
we were way out in the field someplace, out in the middle of nowhere, and it was basically a classroom setting, but he claimed they wouldn't let him do it in Infantry Hall, but they liked it so much they let him go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What were your, what was your weapons training like?
We trained in just about everything that you would use as, you know, in a rifle platoon. We received trainings with M60s, 50 caliber machine guns, 81 millimeter mortars. We actually fired them and learned to sight them. At the time, all our rifle training was with M14s, because they didn't have enough M16s to use in training, and they were just making the transition, I think, in Vietnam about 66. I'm not exactly sure when that took place, but they didn't have enough M16s that
mm-hmm.
we had those. We were still got training with rifle-propelled grenades, which I never saw again. And the M79 grenade launcher hadn't been out too long. We received training in that, and of course with hand grenades, how to call in airstrikes, call in artillery, anything you might be useful in the field.
How are you as a leader? You mentioned at college you were very involved in a lot of extracurriculars, including the Student Senate, and you go into the Benning, and you're going to be a platoon leader in Vietnam. How did you see yourself as a leader?
I thought I was pretty good, and I think that was pretty much shared. The fellow I was telling was our administrative platoon leader was a very sharp man, and I wish to this day I remembered his name. But we had a administrative company commander who was just he was terrible. He was kind of a martinet. I wasn't even sure he was tall enough to have met the requirement to get in the service. And and we were told later on he'd been relieved of command, and they put him in there because they didn't know what to do with him at the time. And he was just a terrible person. Just because he just harassed people, you know, like at formation and stuff for no good reason. And this the administrative platoon leader brought me and three or four other fellows in and told us that he thought that we were the people that had some potential in his platoon, and he wanted us to know that we needed to watch this guy, and whatever he did, make sure that we never did anything like that. It would be the best example of negative leadership we ever saw.
Wow.
And he had the DSC. He was quite the. His father had been a general, and his grandfather had been a general. He was a West Pointer, and he picked up the DSC as a LRP platoon leader in early '67, late '66. And I actually ended up, I think, number 3 out of 200 in leadership in that particular class, and number 1 in tactics. And at ROTC summer camp, I'd come out number 1 out of 2,500 on the academic part of it, which was mostly had to do with tactics and things.
Wow.
And so
that's very impressive.
All right, well, it was like I said, that's what I wanted to do, and I really enjoyed the thinking part of combat.
Yes, sir. What would you say was the most challenging thing about your training at Benning?
Probably the physical part of it. We even though at ROTC summer camp and stuff, we done a lot of physical training and all. It was I don't know if I'd ever been any place where the humidity was as bad as it was at Benning in the summer. And, of course, we were running from one place to another. They'd run us down to infantry hall, and then we'd stand out in the sun for 45 minutes because we would get there early. And we had a student company commander who actually made things a little bit bearable because he was actually outranked our administrative company commander. He'd had a Ph.D. in cultural anthropology, a man named Stein, and he'd been over in Ethiopia, and they'd called him back. They finally told him he'd been, avoiding his commitment long enough, and so he was actually a captain. And he used to give us some really funny. He'd sit there after we'd run, someplace for, and then have to wait an hour before we could go into class. He would sit there and explain to us why this was necessary, and the administrative company commander would just go nuts because he wouldn't actually understand half of what the man was saying. And we had kind of an unusual class in that at the time they were making all the military intelligence officers go through infantry school so they would understand, what it was, why they needed to get certain kinds of intelligence and what kind of intelligence would be good. And about 70 to 80% of this particular class were actually military intelligence officers, and they didn't have to pass, they just had to attend. And so the attitude was a little different in this class than some of the other ones, just because sometimes they would just decide they were fed up with something and they weren't gonna go out and roar when somebody told them to roar, for instance. And so it was kind of a different experience maybe than some other people had because
right.
of that.
Before we leave Fort Benning, how applicable was all of your training there to what you actually experienced in country in Vietnam?
I think it gave you a good solid basis to work out from. The school solution never works because the situation never is exactly the same. But they certainly gave you a lot of after action reports to work with and spent a lot of time on things that had actually happened in Vietnam and why a particular action may have turned out to the way it had and what might have been done differently.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of that was, I think, very applicable to what we were doing.
And
certainly I think that I would have to say the majority of the training was really well done, and it really was trying to prepare you the best that they could for going into the situation over there. I
mm-hmm.
think that, of course, and that's just the way the military does things. They spend a lot of time trying to get you psyched up, so to speak, so that, you didn't like the Viet Cong. You know, we ran around singing little songs to the tune of Poison Ivy about,
mm-hmm.
Charlie Cong and things. And pretty much you recognize that for what it was and took that with a grain of salt. But they were very, very big into being gung-ho and, you get over there and, get the job done and, psychologically trying to get you sort of like a football team to go over there and have
mm-hmm.
the winning attitude.
Mm-hmm. Did that work?
With some people, I think that wasn't what the job was about. The job was about to go over there and get the objective accomplished and lose as few people as possible and
mm-hmm.
none if you could.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, I used to think that was, that it was possible if you did it all right that you wouldn't lose anybody, but that doesn't work very well. So.
Yes, sir. So tell me, when you finished Benning, is this in the fall of 67?
Right. It would have been in the end of September.
Okay. Where did you go from there?
I went from there to Fort Carson, Colorado, to the 5th Mechanized Infantry Division.
Okay. And what did you do at Fort Carson?
I was the battalion communications officer for the 1st Battalion, 10th Infantry.
Okay.
And that was sort of an interesting how I got that job, because that's not what I wanted to do, of course.
Right.
And I reported in, and Carson was just full of Vietnam returnees.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of second lieutenants. I mean, there were just second lieutenants every place. They had assistant platoon leaders in almost every rifle platoon.
Mm-hmm.
And so I reported in to the, and we had Lieutenant Colonel William LeGros, who was actually became a little, I guess he had his moments of fame. One of the best leaders, most decent people I think I ever met. In the book No Decent Inevitable about the CIA pullout in Vietnam at the end of the war,
mm-hmm.
he was the head of MACV Intelligence, who probably ruined his career by telling them they were going to be overrun, and the CIA disagreed with that. And he got all his people out, evidently.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, a lot of the other intelligence agencies didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But Colonel LeGros at the time was a lieutenant colonel, and he called me in, saw that I was an ROTC officer, and most of the officers in the battalion were OCS. And he said, "John," he said, "you can be an assistant platoon leader out there and run the platoon every other week, or do something. Or," he said, "you can take over the battalion communications platoon report pretty much to me. And he said, leadership is leadership. He said, whether you're leading a rifle platoon or a communications platoon, he said, the principles are the same, and getting to know how to get the men to do the job is what's important, and that's what you'll learn here. And he says, I think you can learn a lot more about that in this position because it'd be your own platoon than you mm-hmm. can going to a rifle platoon.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that for the 9 months or so that I was there, and he was absolutely right. I mean, it was a great experience for me. I got to learn to work with my sergeants, stuff about things I would, I would have never had an idea about, and a lot about paperwork also,
mm-hmm.
and had a great platoon sergeant who pretty much wanted to spend most of his time at the NCO club. He was on the board there, but he knew how things worked and how to get things done, and he mm-hmm. taught me an awful lot about how the Army really worked as opposed to how it was supposed to work. So,
can you give me some examples?
Oh, for instance, we had a lot of excess equipment because it was really difficult to get things through supply channels.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, if you're going to have an inspection, that's a huge no-no to have equipment that wasn't on the books. Parts, and for instance, you were allowed to have, at the time we had some radios that still had tubes in them, and you were allowed to have two of these tubes, so they go out all the time, and it might take you a month to get new ones,
mm-hmm.
because when you got down to one, you were supposed to order and keep your inventory up to a certain level. Well, what would happen, you'd have one go out, and the next one would be no good, and suddenly you wouldn't have any, and your radios wouldn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he would do is he'd have all these parts and things squirreled away, and when the rumors came down that we were going to get an inspection, and you always got 3 or 4 hours notice on things, he would have one of his buddies from another battalion bring a truck over, load all this stuff into it, and just go out and have it kind of run around the reservation until the inspection was over, and then we'd bring all the stuff back in. And we were never down.
Mm-hmm.
We had one of those old World War II generators that they use on the radios that you see in the movies, where it has a kind of the three stool cornered stool, and the guy sits on it and cranks this little generator by hand, has the handles on each side.
Yes, sir.
And I was going to get rid of that because that was of absolutely no use. We didn't have anything that we would run.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, oh, no, Lieutenant, you can't get rid of that. He says, and I said, why? And he said, just trust me. So we go out to the field. We have one of the big M115, I think it was, or M114. It was one of those command tracks. He throws this thing in there when we go out to the field. And so the first night at bivouac, we're out bivouac by this little trout stream. He goes out, gets some of the communications wire, strips it back, ties rocks around it, throws it out into the little stream, hooks it up to this little hand generator, and cranks up a few trout for us each that night. So he was always working some angle. He
mm-hmm.
was a good fellow. But
right.
taught me a lot about how things worked, and actually got me a citation. When we were up, we went to the Martin Luther King riots in April of 68 in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
They sent us up there. And so one of the things he thought we were going to need was a loudspeaker system. And the Army didn't have any portable loudspeaker systems. And he knew how to hook up some kind of an inverter vibrator, I'm pretty sure it was called. It actually turned the DC current coming off the battery into AC that you could actually run a little PA system off of. And so we'd taken one of our weapons carriers and hooked these loudspeaker systems up and actually had a loudspeaker system that worked. And of all the federal troops in Chicago, we were the only ones that had one of those. And somebody took notice, and the brigade commander got a nice write-up from the three-star general out of Fort Hood who was in charge of the federal troops up there about that. And so, mm-hmm. I got a nice write-up and And Sergeant Duckworth was the one that, you know, and he'd known how to do that from Korean War or someplace, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But evidently a lot of that knowledge had been lost someplace because there wasn't anything in any of the books about how you could make a, you know, loudspeaker system with the system you had.
Right. What was Chicago like during those riots?
Actually, that was one of the funnier experiences in my military career, I guess you could say. My particular battalion was called the IRE, the Immediate Readiness Element, for the division.
Mm-hmm.
And the riots had been going on for the better part of a week, and we were restricted to post. I actually lived off post. I had an apartment with another fellow. And about third or fourth day, every day we would pack up all the trucks, put all the people in them, issue the weapons, issue the put the ammunition in the trucks, issue the signal operating instructions for the radio, you know, the crypt, the code stuff, and we would drive off to Peterson Field there in at the outskirts of Colorado Springs, and we'd come up over this little hill, and we'd get down there, and we'd turn around, and we'd go back, and we'd done that, I guess, about four different times, just to see how much time it would take us to make sure we had everything packed, and after about 5 days, you know, I needed to get back to the to my apartment, because I was running out of clean clothes, and so I'd gone back there, and all of a sudden, we did get some clean clothes, and they called us up, and so I got back out to the post and had all my underwear in a dryer someplace out back at the apartment complex, and they had us load up, and then they said, oh, here we go again. So I told this one of the people in the apartment complex, would you get my stuff out of there, and I'll pick it up later. And we go out over the little hill coming into Peterson Field, and there was about 21 C-141s lined up with their back doors down.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just drove on to the planes, and off we went to Chicago. I was on the plane with Colonel LeGros, and we were actually the first federal troops to land in Chicago. And we landed, it seemed to me like it was about 10 o'clock at night. It was fairly late because they couldn't find the flight crews.
Mm-hmm.
At Peterson, they'd all gone into an Air Force base to get some chow.
Mm-hmm.
And they were gone. We set out there for about 2 hours. And I understand after we loaded up and actually took off, it took quite a while to get the rest of the people loaded and out. And it actually started snowing. And all these guys are out there and it's snowing on them. And,
of course,
they didn't have any of the tarps up on the truck. Everything had to be stripped down so it could go on the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And so we get to Chicago, and it was actually drizzling. And the colonel had to go downtown to talk to the FBI and some other people about, you know, what we were supposed to do and report into the general who was already there.
Mm-hmm.
And he turns around to me, and he says, John, now all these people are going to be coming in. And he said, we have to make sure everything looks good because we're going to have television crews out here in the morning, I understand. And so all these planes are landing, and it's about, you know, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, and most of them, as I said, were Vietnam returnees, and I'm a second lieutenant, and I'm the only officer on the ground at the time, and I'm telling them we need to take a string and make sure all the tents are lined up perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
Out on the, because we were camping out on the drainage area, the flat part, and we were around the runway there at the Great Lakes Naval Air Station. And I took a lot of abuse that night. I remember that, you know, and just a huge amount of abuse because it's raining and it was reasonably chilly. But we got everything done, and we finally, you know, some captains and some people showed up to help out with the thing. So I got out of that duty after about an hour or so when we finally got some other officers in there. And then we stayed camped out there for I don't know how long, 3-4 days maybe, just set out there because they didn't want to bring federal troops into the riot area if they didn't have to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they were a little worried because we had such a high percentage of Vietnam returnees that if they took any fire that you know, what you teach people in the Army doesn't necessarily work out in a riot condition, because suppression fire is not a nice thing in a, you know, in a populated area.
Mm-hmm.
So finally, though, there was some intelligence that the black militants were going to show up in Grant Park and then storm the National Guard Armory, which is downtown inside the Loop,
mm-hmm.
and they wanted us to go downtown. So Colonel LeGros had me go out, and we set up kind of an intermediate radio tower so we could talk to the Great Lakes Naval Air Station there. And then we went downtown and convoyed down there in trucks and buses and different things. And we actually had a couple of M11, I think they're called, the command and control armored personnel carrier. They look like little sports cars. They have a 50 caliber machine gun on them, only hold three people, and they're very low and they're very fast. They had a gasoline, I think it was a 280, whatever, the 283, the old Chevrolet engine in them with a couple of four barrels, and they were to actually move out pretty good. So we'd actually brought a couple of those with us, and then we had some gun jeeps and things, and so we get on the highway, and he had told, we had a captain who was the executive officer who'd come back in from the National Guard, had watched the war on TV and wanted to get into it.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Captain Swift or Captain Quick. We used to call him Tom Swift because the guy was just a little strange. because he just was just couldn't wait to get over in combat, and was all gun ho from watching television.
Mm-hmm.
And Colonel LeGros had told him not to break camp because he didn't think we were going to be down there very long, and that the areas under the tents were dry, and he didn't want the men to have to come back in and be on wet ground because we'd had this drizzle off and on.
Mm-hmm.
And so Colonel LeGros leaves. This guy has us break camp. And we get down there, and we lined up on there in Grant Park. I guess it's Grant Park. It's down inside the Loop in Chicago. And we were up toward the Prudential Building, up toward the north end of it, and we were along the big sidewalk facing all the buildings, and we were there company online, platoons online, a whole brigade, you know, of infantry.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a policeman assigned to each one of the units from Chicago because they hadn't declared military law. If we had to make arrests, we needed a civilian officer with us.
Mm-hmm.
And of course they were all pieces of work. They were all going around trying to scarf up on sea rations or anything else they could, and none of these guys could figure out what they were talking about, and then. When they found out how much the police officers were made, everybody said, well, what are we doing here? Why can't you guys do your job? Because, you know, Spec 4, I think at the time, was making about $220 a month, and the policemen were making, I think they were telling us they were making $17,000 a year plus whatever their graph they could get. Mm-hmm. They were pretty honest about how they just took money from people because they couldn't really afford to live on what a policeman made.
Mm-hmm.
And so they weren't getting a whole lot of sympathy from the soldiers. So we'd actually issued out the ammunition and done the whole business, and nobody shows up. Most of the people that showed up at this rally were either FBI agents or newspaper reporters. And so we stood around there for 3 or 4 hours and ended up playing some softball in the park. Finally the vehicles showed up and we went back out, and we got out there and the tents were all down.
Mm.
And the colonel relieved the captain on the spot and told him to find an airplane and get out of there. He didn't want to see him anymore. So
wow.
I don't know what happened to him. He was just incensed that somebody would treat the men. Not that he told him not to do it, and he'd done it. That wasn't the point. But it had rained in the meantime. The ground was wet, and the men were going to be sleeping on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And there had been no point in doing that. So finally, I think we were there about 7 days, and finally the the Air National Guard showed up to take us back. You know, we had all these C-141s to bring us all out there at one time, and we went back kind of a plane load at a time with all kinds of various aircraft. I mean, there was just a lot of prop-driven things, and it, you know, just a whole different scene going back. Took a couple days, I think, to get everybody out of there. And there was a rumor we were going to go into Kansas City because they were still having trouble in Kansas City, and we were actually airborne on our way to Kansas City when they decided that, it was under control and we didn't have to land there and got to go back to Kansas, I mean to Fort Carson.
Right.
We had one other kind of funny thing that affected my platoon. We were in charge of the generator for the camp, but we had a 5-kilowatt generator on a trailer that ran all the lights and things in the bigger tents, and had strung wire. And one night it was pretty nice, and so we went over to the Navy and borrowed a film projector from them, and had a we're going to have a movie, and it was one of the Fu Manchu movies with Christopher Lee. I remember to this day because everybody was kind of excited. They were a little racy at the time. You know, the guys were pretty excited about that. And the exciter light wasn't working right, so there wasn't any sound. And everybody kept complaining. And one of the PFCs in the communications platoon went over and saw that the voltage was only like 115 or something instead of 120. And he decided that's what the problem was. And this guy was somebody we never allowed to do anything much, you know, cleaning equipment and things. And he turned the generator up to get it up to 120, and I was in a tent talking to the colonel about what we're going to have to do the next day, and all the light bulbs exploded. And I went running out to see what was going on, and when I got to the generator, it was at 280 coming down. And I looked over, and the film was on fire in the projector, and the whole thing was burning up. And so we put the film back in a can and put the projector back in a in its case, and we turned it in just as the plane was leaving. So we didn't have to pay the Navy for their projectors.
Sir, why don't we take a break?
Sure.
Okay, sir, let's continue. We go into 1968 here. We've been talking about Chicago and all that. And in June 68, you're leaving Fort Carson. Is that correct?
That's right. If I may, there's a couple more things I think that are sort of interesting about, because you learn different things about how organizations work and where your place is in them and stuff, your experiences. And
yes, sir.
Fort Carson was sort of unique in that we had all of these officers with not too much experience and all these enlisted men that had 3 months to 6 months to go. So it was from a discipline standpoint and learning how to deal with people, it was I think a really good experience for young officers, and that you still had, you know, mission to accomplish and training to do, and then the attitude was not real good, but among some of the troops, because they just wanted to go home. They'd, you know, done their bit and they were wanting to get out. And two other things I think might be worth noting. We had a maneuver, division size maneuver in either late December or January of 1967, 68, anyway, it was midwinter, and we went to the field, the whole division went to the field, and we'd been out about 24 hours, and we were up in the foothills of the Rockies there, and it started to snow, and it continued to snow. We continued to play war out there, you know, we had one brigade against the other. And it continued to snow, and it kept getting colder. The temperatures kept dropping, and it kept continuing to snow. And after about 3 days, the snow was pretty deep. I mean, we're talking over 2 foot, maybe, and it's still snowing, just blizzard conditions up there in the foothills. And two things happened. I learned to drink coffee on that particular. I didn't drink coffee before, and I was so cold, and having grown up in Texas, I wasn't used to real cold weather. And And I was just miserable, and the only thing there was that was warm was peppermint schnapps, which my platoon sergeant carried and some of the other guys, because you couldn't smell the liquor on your breath, and so that tasted pretty good. That
yes,
would warm your stomach up. And the other thing was coffee. And so I went to the field not drinking coffee, and I came out addicted to it, which I am to this day.
You must have had a lot to drink then.
Oh, I drank a lot of coffee. It was unbelievably cold, and you'd be out walking around in the snow. So after about 3 or 4 days of snow, they called, and it's still snowing, they called the maneuver off and told us to go back to our cantonment areas and put the vehicles up. We're out there with all these tracks and tanks and stuff, being a mechanized division.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't see the road. You couldn't see any landmarks. I mean, it was just pretty much miserable, blowing and snowing and blowing. And so we had to put people in front of the vehicles with poles to walk them back to the post. And it took us, it took us 36 hours or so of just continuous movement to finally get back to the post.
Wow.
And vehicles that broke down were pretty much left in place because there wasn't anything to do with them.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't see to mark them because you couldn't see any landmarks to mark a map where you were.
Mm-hmm.
And they got drifted over with snow, and some of them weren't found till like March.
Wow.
And they couldn't fire artillery down range in some of the areas because they didn't know if there was vehicles that were out there, left there. Anyway, I was told that was the case, and by some artillery people.
Mm-hmm.
And the commanding general at the time, we also had 300 cases of suspected frostbite from being out in the snow so much. Absolute miserable time.
Mm-hmm.
And the commanding general at the time got promoted, got his third star, and went to Vietnam as a corps commander. And that gave me the impression that people higher up didn't always know what was going on at other levels.
Mm-hmm.
It was just because it seemed like a complete fiasco.
Mm-hmm.
To the people who were out there actually in the maneuver. And the last thing about Fort Carson, the day I left, the 69th Infantry Brigade from Kansas came in. They'd sent the 3rd Brigade of the 5th MEC to Vietnam, and they called up the Kansas National Guard, this one brigade of infantry, to fill in the slot for the, for the reserve.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I know, they were the only major infantry unit called up during the Vietnam War. And, of course, living in Kansas, I know a lot of people who were in that particular brigade.
Mm-hmm.
And they brought them over there and then sent them all to Vietnam as individual replacements. They'd been promised they weren't going to Vietnam. They were just going to stay in the state as part of the strategic reserve.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Army sent them all to Vietnam, the entire brigade, eventually as individual replacements.
Wow.
And it just kind of reminds me of what goes on right now in Iraq. I have my cousin's son is over there, and he just got extended. For his tour in the National Guard is up in September, and there was they extended him in place until February.
Wow!
So
that's tough.
Yeah, it is tough, and these people they finally brought them all home early.
Mm-hmm.
The congressman from Kansas finally found out what was going on, and started. Got a bill together and had, made the Army all bring them home because
mm-hmm.
the promise had been they wouldn't be sent over there. But they lost quite a few people. I think they're the only National Guard outfit with a Vietnam streamer because they finally gave them a streamer because everybody got sent.
And, right.
So Fort Carson was, it was a good training ground for me. And just because I was lucky enough to have an incredibly smart, good man for a battalion commander who taught me a lot about how things ought to work, and then I saw some things that are probably not how they should work. So.
Right. How did you leave Fort Carson?
Individual orders. I left I think it was the 23rd of May. And for some reason, that date sticks in my mind. And I arrived there in October, and it was spitting snow. And I left on the 23rd of May, and it was spitting snow. I remember that. And I had orders to go to jungle warfare school in Panama.
Mm-hmm.
And since I was a military dependent, I knew how the system worked. And so I told them I was going to drive to Charleston, South Carolina, where the plane left from, and then drive back to San Francisco to go to Vietnam. I was leaving out of Travis Air Force Base here in Oakland, actually. Mm-hmm. And that way I got like, oh, I don't know, it was like 30 days of travel time, because for every 300 miles you went, you got, it was like 15 days, I guess. Anyway, mm-hmm. for every 300 miles, you got one day of travel time.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I immediately drove home in one day to St. Louis, where my parents were living, and had a really good time for about 2 weeks. And then I went to Panama for the jungle training. And then mm-hmm. I came back and had, between my leave and my travel time, I think I got about 48 days off.
Wow.
In between the... And my roommate at Fort Carson couldn't believe that. So he went down and had his orders changed to be to go to the same jungle school that I was going to. He'd been scheduled to go later than I was, just before he went to Vietnam, which was what they did with a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this kind of break in there. And so he ended up with 48 days off before he had to go over, too. He was pretty pleased. So
you received your orders for Vietnam while at Fort Carson?
Yes.
Okay.
And then went to mid-June of 68, went to Panama for the jungle warfare school.
Okay. How did you feel when you received your orders? Were you expecting these?
We were expecting them at some point. You know, I mean, I didn't know where. Most people, they were leaving, most lieutenants, they were leaving in the States for a year. They were trying to give you a year experience in garrison someplace before they sent you over.
Mm-hmm.
And being in the infantry, you know, you pretty much knew that you were going to be going over. I wasn't as excited about going. I don't know if excited is the word. As I said, when I went into Fort Benning, I was worried the war was going to be over. And, of course, by middle of 68, the whole picture had changed, you know,
right.
after Tet. And
were you aware of what had happened with Tet and what was going on?
Of course. I mean, that was just – and what had also happened, and I'd met a lot of especially the senior NCOs that had come back from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these fellows had been in Korea, you know, and some of them even in World War II. We still had some World War II vets left in the Army then. And their impression had started changing mine about what, you know, what we were doing over there and whether we should have been over there, because most of them, a lot of them, felt that the war was not being conducted properly and that it was just a complete snafu, as they said, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so by that time, you know, I was starting to get a little different opinion about what was happening on the ground in Vietnam, and of course then Tet 68 happened, and by that time it looked like we didn't have a clue about, you know, what was going on in, mm-hmm. after a fashion. I mean, certainly from the television reports, we were completely surprised by the size of the offensive, and even though I think, you know, militarily we recovered, I mean, it was certainly a failure in intelligence for sure. So,
mm-hmm.
So by then, and of course, it looked like it had gotten a lot more serious, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I was had a lot more trepidation about going than I had, I think, prior to that point.
How did your family feel about it?
Well, you know, being a military family, they were worried. I mean, they were very worried about me going over there, especially, you know, being the infantry. But they kept a good stiff upper lip and told me to, you know, do my job and do what I've been trained, and I'd be okay and come home.
Okay.
Which is about, I mean, what else are you going to do? They weren't, you know, they spent their whole life, you know, and the reason they call it the service, I think it is almost like a calling to some people, and they were very much in, you know, I think they were very proud that I was an officer and that I was wanting to serve my country, and they were very supportive in that.
Okay. Tell me about going down to Panama. What was that like?
Panama, there's no other word for it. Panama sucks. People down there. We went down and we flew down there, landed at night, and crossed the isthmus in a bus.
Mm-hmm.
And I was confused the entire time I was down there. I hadn't done my homework properly. Didn't realize the canal actually runs kind of north and south instead of east and west. And I didn't know that the air base that we landed on was actually on the Pacific side, and we crossed at night to the Atlantic side. So the jungle train was always actually on the Atlantic or the Caribbean side of the isthmus.
Mm-hmm.
And for the whole time I was there, I thought we were on the Pacific side because we'd come from the East Coast, you know, flown from the East Coast, landed and crossed the. And I was just, and we were out in the jungle, so you couldn't see much, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought the whole time we were there. And the maps only covered, you know, they'd cover like 20 kilometers or something, so you couldn't really tell anything from the maps most of the time as far as, you know, where your position was in the big picture of Panama.
Mm-hmm.
And so the whole time I was there, you know, which was, I think at that time they were only running the school for 2 weeks, it was really more of an acclimatization and familiarization with the jungle kind of a thing than really giving you any kind of super training, you know, because you were there with, you were always out with small groups of people, you know, and so it was more like patrol training than something, you know, than company or platoon kind of maneuver.
Right.
And it was right at the beginning of the rainy season, and, you know, I'd never been in the jungle, and the jungle there, compared to the jungle in Vietnam, I think was much worse, at least in the area that that I was in Vietnam. The jungle in Panama was absolutely just dense, nasty. It seemed like every tree had thorns. The ants would leave their ant trails and attack you. I mean, it was just insects, incredible number of insects in Panama compared to Vietnam, where we were.
Can you describe the training in general, what they were teaching you and preparing you for?
Basically, they were teaching us, I think, just how to be miserable in the jungle, and they did a good job of that. So it was like, you know, acclimatizing, learning to handle the terrain, to handle the kind of weather, to run patrols. I mean, we ran a lot of patrols did just a lot of basic kind of, you know, river crossing kind of things, little five-man groups of deals. We'd run patrols, and they'd give us BB guns and little face masks, and they would have aggressor troops out there, and they'd shoot you in your face mask, and you never would see them. I mean, it was really kind of an eye-opener from that standpoint that somebody could hit you with a BB gun and you wouldn't even realize they were there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they were really good with them. Whoever, you know, I think they had some special forces people out there acting as aggressors.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like they always hit you either in the chest or the face mask. So, you know, it didn't give you a good feeling about things. Taught us a little bit about booby traps, taught a lot about survival. You had a lot of, you know, what you can eat, what you can't eat in the jungle kind of training, which I hoped I was never going to get to use, and thank God never had to.
Mm-hmm.
And then just reading maps and a lot of map reading and trying to get from point A to point B, which is really difficult if you don't have anything to take resections on, and, you know, learning terrain navigation.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last part of the training was an escape and evasion course, where they would put you on in five-man groups take everything away from you and say, okay, you got to get to the coast, which was, I don't know, 6 or 7 kilometers away. I'm not sure how far it was. And you had one map, and you were supposed to stick together, and there was partisan points you were supposed to go into and get food and more information about where enemy patrols. They had aggressor patrols out there. They'd done the same thing at Benny, and we'd had escape and evasion mm-hmm. classes at Fort Carson, too. But in Panama, they pretty much let the terrain take care of the difficult part of it. And if you got caught in Panama, usually in the other courses, they'd put you in some kind of prison camp scenario.
Right.
And in Panama, they just made you start over. Which was punishment enough. We actually had people in the class that had been to Vietnam that quit partway through it just because the terrain and, you know, it was just nasty there. And I think they decided they'd had enough of that. So we had a couple officers who were going through it that had actually quit partway through the course. And, and we had, you know, several people hurt down there. It was just nasty terrain.
How did you do personally?
It was fine. I think that I got my jungle expert badge and got out and I didn't I wish I'd been in better shape. I'd already been on leave for 30 days before I went down there, and so mm-hmm. the first few days was pretty miserable mm-hmm. because I hadn't done any exercise or anything while I was away, and so it took me a little while to get acclimatized to that. Mm-hmm. And having been raised in Texas, the heat didn't bother me as much as some of the people did. The humidity was terrible, mm-hmm. but I was going to see. You know, we saw animals, we saw jaguars and sloths, and I mean, there was a lot of interesting things to see down there. But it was just generally pretty mean. I learned to sleep in a hammock, and I pretty much didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
One day. We I didn't think in some ways it was realistic. I mean, basically it was, like I said, they were just pretty much climatizing to you and teaching you to read a map in the jungle, and mm-hmm. I went down there thinking it was going to be more like Vietnam training, and it turned out I was a little disappointed in the level of the training, I guess, what it was doing. I mm-hmm. thought there'd be more.
How much was applicable to Vietnam?
Certainly the map reading part was. And after that, not much.
Okay.
We went downtown one day to Cologne on a Sunday, and I spent about 3 hours down there and got out. Panama was just a scary place, I think. The National Guard there, you know, just beat people on the streets just for fun. And they actually beat up one of the guys that stayed down there too long from our unit. I think he was pretty bad shape. He ended up in the hospital. I don't know what happened. He claimed he just looked at him wrong. We had... one of the interesting things about it, we had some British troops with us. There was a lieutenant or a lieutenant, I guess as they call them, four or five members of the Green Howards, which is one of the British Army regiments, and they were stationed in British Honduras, which at that time was getting ready to, become its own, go into the Commonwealth as a free nation. And this fellow had actually been through the British Jungle Warfare School in Malaysia, which mm-hmm. is like 6 months long and a much different kind of thing, and had been platoon leader for a while with the Gurkhas in New Guinea when they were having some trouble with the Indonesians.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just an interesting fellow to be around, because getting around in the jungle really wasn't a problem for him. He'd spent a lot of time in the jungle, and he had a compass. You know, we had these Linzatic compasses, like the Army issues, you know, where you can sight through the little wire and get your bearings. And he had a compass that was more like a Boy Scout compass. It was a little plastic plate with a compass stuck on top and an arrow. And we'd be out navigating, and he'd always come out within about 10 meters of where we were supposed to end up, and we were lucky to be within 200 or 300 meters.
Wow.
He was extremely extremely good and very helpful in teaching us things that they didn't teach us there. I was lucky to be in the same team that he was on, I thought. And we had a couple of Air Force Academy cadets, and they were wondering what they were doing down there after about 3 or 4 days. And the escape and evasion thing at the end was probably the most memorable because they stick you out and they tell you not to move at night, you know. And, of course, they've taken away your hammocks and there's all these insects and scorpions and things in the ground. So all you had was a canteen. So we decided after we went to the first partisan point, they called it, where you could pick up some sea rations and then check in. Part of the reason they wanted you to do there was to know where you were and so you could check in. But they were also patrolling those pretty heavy with the aggressor forces. So you had to be very careful. So we went to the first one, and we decided after looking at the map that if we really pushed hard, we could make it all the way to the coast in one day instead of spending the night out in the jungle. But we'd have to skip the other two partisan points. And there was a, in our group, there was a another captain in the armor who'd been in the National Guard and had come back in, and two other infantry lieutenants and myself and an Air Force Academy cadet. And so this captain was saying, no, we couldn't do that. That was, you know, we had these rules that, you know, we couldn't do that. And so we sort of took a vote, and he voted against it, and the three infantry lieutenants voted for it, and the Air Force Academy guy didn't know what to do, so he abstained, and we decided we were going to push for the coast, and the captain told us that we couldn't do that. He was giving us a direct order. And of course, under those in those kind of scenarios, there's really nobody in charge exactly. I mean, he should have been in charge, but we decided he wasn't an infantry officer, so we weren't going to pay any attention to him. And so we pushed through the coast that night, made it to the coast about 10 o'clock. You weren't supposed to move after dark. And it turned out, I think over half the class did that. I mean, we kept running into people, and once it got dark, they pulled the aggressor troops out. And so we were able to actually get down close to the river and just push all the way into the coast and go, you know, get back and sleep in a bed that night. And
so you all did well.
And it turned out that checking into the partisan points and stuff, none of that counted. The only thing that counted was whether you made it to the coast. And so that, and again, there's a good lesson there, you know, that that when you're in some kind of a critical situation, the ends are what matters, you know, the goal, and not exactly whether you follow every rule to get there. So so anyway, but Panama, it was a hugely interesting experience, and I have never wanted to go back there. I just did not not care for the place, and the poverty was incredible there. I think I spent a tour in Vietnam and mostly rural area, all in rural areas, and in Korea up just down from the DMZ, and of course there's all a lot of rural area in that area, farmers. And never seen the kind of poverty, that you see in Panama. I mean, it was just absolutely the, you know, just the dregs of human condition there. I just felt really bad for people down there.
So did you leave? You went back to the States and
went
you had a little time off.
Went back to the States, and I had another couple of weeks before I went to had to report into Travis.
Okay. And tell me about your departure out of Travis. Were you on civilian air?
Yes, and I can't remember if it was, I think it was a World Airways jet. Reported in to Travis, I think I was supposed to leave about 11 at night, got there around 8, turned off, out that I'd been left off the manifest. Actually, there was me and a number of people that I had been in the Combat Platoon Leaders course and in Panama and Fort Benning with it. We were all scheduled to be on the same plane. And so I was kind of, you know, that was a kind of a neat thing. We were all going to get together and fly over. And it turned out I'd been left off the manifest, and so I ended up having to fly Space Available to Vietnam. I had to wait around, but they got me on one about 3 in the morning and flew to Japan.
What was that flight over like? What was your mood?
Well, it was a pretty miserable flight, actually. You had a lot of people that had too much to drink on there, and so you had a lot of sick people, and some, you know, you had people that were just, you know, really moody and just worried. You couldn't sleep. It was a DC, it was a stretch 8, so they had just as many people as they could, you know, stuffed in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't sleep well on airplanes and never have, never still don't. And they brought a book, and I was reading a book and talking to people around me, and it was pretty much subdued. I don't think there was a whole lot of, wasn't a whole lot of talk. Certainly wasn't many people very jovial. The flight crew was incredibly nice. Matter of fact, the flight crews, I just, both trips going and coming, you couldn't say enough about how decent the people on those flight crews were, those civilian airlines. And it was just a terribly long flight. I mean, you flew into Japan, it seems to me like that was about 10 hours or 9. Mm-hmm. It was a long flight. And they refueled there in Japan, and they let you off the airplane into one little area in the airport. But they sat on the airplane for a long time, and then it turned out they were having some trouble getting fuel or something, so they finally let us off for a while. And there was some major, I have no idea who he was, that told me I needed to get a haircut. I remember that. I was on the plane, and he saw me out in the lobby and told me there was a barber shop there and told me I needed to get a haircut. And I pretty much ignored that, so I figured I'd never see him again. But they had a lot of MPs in there to make sure people weren't going to, try to make a break for it or something.
Right.
And then we got back on the plane and flew from there to Tansanute.
Mm-hmm.
And again, and the closer you got, and there wasn't much to see. It was night. I remember flying over the Philippines. That was about the only thing, you finally saw some lights and things down there, and so that everybody went to the windows, and then they finally announced we were off the coast of Vietnam, and, that people all of a sudden, the excitement picked up, There was a lot more talk and people looking out the windows, and you were finally there, and just everybody was starting wondering what they were going, where they were going, what they were going to do, so then we flew along the coast until we got to Tansanute, and they announced that they just had a rocket attack, and we were to debark as quickly as they could land the plane. And my first impression, it was, I don't know what time it was. It was probably mid-morning sometime when we got there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, and this was late July, I don't remember exactly the date I got there. I'm thinking it was like the 28th or the 29th, but it was real late in July.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, I think I made first lieutenant like 3 or 4 days before we hit Vietnam, but I didn't get my orders changed or my pay for about another 5 months. They couldn't get it straightened out.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember when I got to the door, it was just like a blast for us. I mean, I just don't ever remember walking into something and just feeling the heat like it was coming off the tarmac there.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, everybody was running out and heading across the tarmac toward, where they were having people get into because they'd had this rocket attack. And then there was all these guys standing out there, ready to get on the same plane.
Mm-hmm.
They were all sort of jeering and yelling at people, I mean, they were, it was kind of, good-hearted after a fashion, but saying you'll be sorry, stuff like that. And they were all heading out, and I mean, they were all just as happy. You never saw a group of happier people, and mm-hmm. I know just how they felt a year later.
So they were actually kind of taunting in a good way.
Yes, not being nasty at all.
Mm-hmm.
So we get there and they unload the plane and my duffel bag isn't there.
Oh boy!
So all I have is the clothes on my back. I don't even have a shaving kit because it's in my duffel bag.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've got a set of khakis and evidently they'd put my duffel bag on the other plane.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this mound of duffel bags there, and I asked somebody, what's that? And they said, that's all the ones that come in unclaimed. And, I mean, this thing must have been 2 stories high and 100 feet across at the base. It was huge. And I'm thinking, oh, this is a bad deal. So they put us on the bus, and I remember there was green wire on the windows, and we go from there over to Benoit to the repo depot. And we report in, and some sergeant read us Westmoreland's letter of welcome. That was, you know, kind of the attention. Everyone, we were all sitting in, like, little desk and around, and we filled out a bunch of paperwork, and they took it, and they put me in a, you know, a temporary BOQ. It was basically, you know, it was just a barracks, and it was all temporary BOQ, everybody bunk beds and typical barracks. And said, you know, we were waiting for orders, and they showed us where it would be, the orders would be posted, and every day they would come out there, and they'd have a whole big list of people's names and what unit you're going to. You know, I could say 101st, and it'd give the names of the people being assigned to that unit, the officers under that. And my duffel bag doesn't come in. I didn't have any money, and so I'm borrowing shaving cream and stuff from people, and I'm thinking I'm going to have to go get a new uniform pretty soon because I'm not smelling very good here, you know. And I think I'd been there 3 days, and finally, in the afternoon of the third day, my name appears, you know, on the list. You go out there, you know, two or three times. They'd post it two or three times a day. You go out and check. And here I am, and I'm the only one that says AmeriCal 23rd Division. And my name's the only name there. And all these other guys are going to the 20th. And I'd never heard of the AmeriCal Division. So I go back to this little temporary officers club they had. And went back in there, and so I'm asking around, you know. And there was this guy who was waiting to leave. And he looked up at me, and he said, "You poor motherfucker, you're going to I Corps."
Oh, boy.
And that's the only thing anybody ever said. And I thought, well, you know, I knew where I Corps was.
Right.
But, you know, I never heard of the AmeriCal Division. So so I went out the next day. They took me, put me in a Jeep because I was the only one going, and take me back out to Thompson Newt. And there's a C-130 out, and we're right by this big pile of duffel bags again, and I still don't have my stuff.
Right.
And I go out, and I start looking around because it's a little time, and I said, "Well, can I look around?" They said, "Yeah." And the second one I looked at was mine.
Wow.
It was down at the bottom. I mean, it was just incredible luck, you know. So I'm feeling pretty good, and I walk onto this C-130, and there's me and a whole bunch of Arvin officers and NCOs and their wives and their kids and their goats. And we all get on this C-130 and fly up to Chulai. And so that was an interesting trip, you know. I mean, I'm on here with, I don't know how long it took us, but I'm on here with all these goats, and I think, well, so this is kind of bizarre.
Right. Did you, were you able to talk with any of the Arvin troops?
A couple of the officers spoke a little bit of English, and mostly I talked with the loadmaster and stuff. You know, I wasn't, you know, but I was, you know, a little paranoid, I suspect. I didn't know what to expect from who or what. You know, I was just wanting to go over and, you know, and by this time I think I was, you know, getting pretty nervous about what was going to happen, and you know I hadn't started off real good, having no clothes or anything, and I'm the only one going up there, so I don't have anybody else I know to talk to. And I get up to Chulai, and they sent me to the AmeriCal Division combat course that they had for lasted about a week after you first got in country. And that was down on the beach, and they had all these tent kits, and the officers were up in one area, and the enlisted men down in the other, you know, up on the dunes up behind the beach. And so that was a, you know, we'd have training, kind of a regular training day, and it was just miserably hot because this was in, this would have been around the 1st of August. And I forget, it was the 1st of August, and I don't know what the temperature was getting to down on the beach, but I'm sure it was, you know, up near 100. And that's in the dry season over there, so it's just very hot. And you know, but the ocean was pretty, and they had a little club up there, and we'd go up there every night and drink, and they, you know, and
who would you go with?
The other guys in the tents, the new people I met. There was actually a couple of guys. By the time I got there, there were some fellows that I'd been in combat platoon leaders course with that were there at the same time. And they'd been on that plane I was supposed to be on originally.
Right.
And it turned out it had engine trouble and landed in Hawaii. And they'd spent 2 days in Hawaii, down on the beach in Hawaii while they were fixing the plane.
Okay.
And all that time counted toward being in Vietnam. And I was a little upset that I hadn't made the right, I had to go space available. But so we got there and we'd go down and they'd have, they'd have movies in there, and I think one night they had some Korean showgirls that were in there, and so they'd have little things there at night. And in the daytime, we'd go through, like, booby trap trails, and they'd teach us how to spot booby traps. And, of course, they'd have little, like, firecracker kind of things hooked up, and you'd trip the wire, and then they'd tell you how you missed it and what it was doing. And, and some of them were just pretty clever, and that made you worry. And you had weapons familiarization again, and that's the first time I got to fire an M16 was there. And they one day we went up and they wanted to know if you wanted to throw a hand grenade, and it was sort of a your choice kind of a deal. And most of the fellows in the infantry didn't want to throw one because we'd done it already, and of course we'd all been worried, warned about, hand grenades are not your friend kind of thing. And, but a couple of the division clerks had never thrown one, and they wanted to throw one. So this one fellow went into the pit with a sergeant, threw the grenade, and had a short fuse on it, and it blew up about 15 feet out of his hand. And that's the first guy I saw hurt over there. He and the sergeant were both hurt pretty badly, and they medevaced him.
Wow.
And so then we went back to the beach, and the only other thing other than the booby trap trail, and of course they made us go into the gas chamber like they always do, and you have these sadistic guys in there make you take your mask off and ask you questions, and we went through that whole thing, and it was really hot in there, and when you're sweating, that CS gas is just bad. It just really starts making your skin burn, and So that was probably the worst gas chamber experience I ever had, because the guy in there just kept asking questions after questions, especially if he found out you were an officer. He would just keep you in there for a long time with your mask off. So we did that, the booby trap trail, and then we had a lecture on the Geneva Convention. They got everybody up in some grandstands, and some guy from the JAG, it was a captain from the JAG office, came out and gave us a lecture on the Geneva Convention. And it was my first indication that things probably weren't as they should be over there. They were having a little racial problem along the beach. You had to be careful at night because there was bands of black or white troops kind of roaming the beach looking for people.
Really?
So they had some racial trouble there in Chulai, which was just a huge, huge base. I don't know how big that place was, but, they had Air Force and all kinds of people on there. But this JAG officer came out and told a story, and I think it was about an outfit in the 198th Light Infantry Brigade that had captured some nurses, and it was pretty sordid. And it turned out that they ended up murdering one of these nurses, and, I mean, this was the story anyway. And the other one they'd sent back to the rear, and then she'd turned them all in for murder, and there was, gang rape and several really bad things here. And they'd been out in the jungle, and of course, they'd court-martial all kinds of people and send them to jail and stuff. But the moral of his story was that, you can't trust your buddies not to turn you in. And that was, to me, the first indication that, something's just not quite right here. I mean, to me, that wasn't what the moral of the story should have been. And that stuck with me, I guess, my whole life, obviously. Here I am 33 years later, and I remember this guy standing up there, and I'm thinking, what is this all about? Then I got my orders to go down to the 11th Infantry Brigade, and after my week there, and they put me on a C-123 to fly down to Duc Pho. and it was full of mail. I remember that. It was all full of mail pallets. You just had all kinds of pallets hooked in there. Mm-hmm. And as we came in there, they just had a small mortar attack, and the guy came in at an angle I couldn't believe. A C-123 will land on a, practically on a dime. I mean, they're made to, for short landings, and I thought we were crashing. We were coming in so steep, and they actually then went off onto the taxiway and started kicking the mail pallets out the back without stopping.
Right.
To let them pick up, and they just had us sort of jump out, and then they flew back, got on the runway, and took off again. So, I mean, they slowed up to probably, 2 or 3 miles an hour, and just we threw our stuff out and jumped out. And I got there, and, of course, I didn't know where I was going. There was all these trucks to pick up the enlisted men because they'd all had orders to some unit, and I was just assigned 11th Light Infantry Brigade. And so they had, I went in and finally got somebody to call the S1, and they sent a Jeep over and picked me up after about an hour. And I get over there, and there was a major that was the S1 officer for the brigade, and he gets me a Coke and says, okay, do you want to spend your first 6 months in the field or in the rear? And because he said, we've got positions open both places. And I said, well, I just as soon get it over with. And he said, you sure? And I said, yeah. And so he says, okay. And so I sat there for about an hour or so, and he comes back. He has a set of orders and assigned me to the 1st of the 20th, Alpha Company, 1st of the 20th Infantry. And Jeep comes and picks me up. And I've been told at Chulai that, from the time I left Chulai, it'd probably be another week, a week and a half before I actually got assigned in the field. It takes them forever to get that done, right? So this Jeep picks me up. We go over the 1st of the 20th. Guy types up some papers, sends me over to the Alpha Company guy. They take my duffel bag, start pulling, the first sergeant starts pulling stuff out of it, hands me a rucksack, starts and I start to put stuff in there. He says, you don't need that. And he put it back in the duffel bag and pretty much, threw the stuff in, took me over to the Army, got me a armory, got me a weapon and and a 45, and then took me up to the ammo supply point and got me 7 magazines and a couple of hand grenades and marched me back down to the helipad. Said, wait here, there's going to be a helicopter coming to go to LZ Thunder. He said, you need to be on it.
Okay.
And left me there. And so about...
How are you feeling at this point?
Well, at this point, I was just totally confused. And, I was really getting apprehensive because things were moving much faster than I thought they were going to move. I mean, I'd really come in there and think, okay, I'll be here a couple of days, get familiarized with some stuff, learn something. I didn't learn anything about... Didn't know anybody's name, didn't know anything, and they're just throwing this stuff in there and moving me out. And he sent a sandwich down because I hadn't even had a chance to eat. So he sent somebody down with a sandwich. And so I'm sitting out there eating, and helicopter shows up. They throw a whole bunch of stuff on it. I get on it and get out, and that was my first helicopter ride. So I'm talking to these guys in the helicopter, and we got out there just about dark. And, I mean, I remember how pretty it was because the sun was going down behind the mountains up at Duck Foe, the coastal plains, probably, maybe 10 kilometers wide. It's not very wide. The mountains actually south of there come down and touch the ocean, and then they kind of sweep out as you go up more toward Kwangnai City in Chulai. So you got the ocean on one side in the helicopter in the mountains with the sun going down on the other side. It was just a beautiful country. I mean, to this day, I don't know if I've ever seen prettier places than some places in Vietnam. They're just, it's just, just lush and green. And the rice paddies are also, were all well kept and, all level. And then there'd be these big hills sitting in the middle of them, and we'd have fire bases on them.
Right.
And so on one of these big hills was LZ Thunder, and they landed me on the helicopter pad, and by that time it was dark, and all these guys are pulling stuff off, and finally I'm just standing there, and finally somebody says, what are you here for? And I said, I'm supposed to go up to Alpha Company 1st of the 20th, and he said, I'll call somebody, and this Jeep comes bouncing down the hill with its lights on, and I get on it, and we bounce up the hill to a bunker. And I walk in. They said, go into that bunker. There'll be somebody who can help you. So I go in there and walk in, and here's a bunch of guys sitting around, and one of them's got no shirt on, a little bitty, looks like almost like a Vietnamese guy, dark-skinned guy, and turned out to be my platoon sergeant. And he says, who are you? And I said, I'm Lieutenant McNown, the new lieutenant here. And so, yeah, we heard you were coming. And he hands my rucksack to somebody and tells him to take it down to the bunker. And the guy says, I just got off bunker duty. He said, I have to get somebody else to take it. And Sergeant Wright picked up a entrenching tool and hit the guy upside the shoulder as hard as he could, knocked him over, picked him up and says, when I tell you to do something, you do it.
Wow.
And the guy picks it up, leaves, and he said, come on, they're having a meeting down there. And down at the command bunker, so I go down there, and they were just breaking up from, because they were moving off the hill. This was at probably about 9 o'clock at night, and they were moving off the hill at 3 the next morning.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, talking about the operation, getting the operation all set up. And I walked in there just as the meeting was breaking up, and I met the other platoon leaders. The company commander was either on R&R. He wasn't there. One of the other platoon leaders, Ray Enners, was acting as company commander for the time being. And he was brand new. He'd only been there about a month, maybe. And the other platoon leader from... walked up to me and started talking, and I'd been in the infantry officer, you know, in combat platoon leaders course with him. We'd been in the same company, and he remembered who I was. We'd been in different platoons, and it was kind of funny because he was stuttering and smoking, and I didn't remember him doing either thing. And I asked him, I said, have you been here a long time? And he said, no. And I said, so have you seen a bunch of action? And he said, no, I haven't been off the hill yet. And so, because I was thinking, oh, my gosh, it must be terrible.
Right.
You know? But it turned out I think he'd had a little stutter. So I don't know how he'd gotten into the infantry to begin with. Anyway, he hadn't smoked. He started smoking after he got there. So, so introduced to the other guys in the room there, and we went over and tried to get some sleep, and at 3 o'clock we walked off the hill. And
how receptive was everybody to you, the new guy?
The other officers were very nice, of course.
Right.
And they wouldn't actually assign a platoon to me, even though Brad was the first platoon leader and Ray was the third platoon leader. Because the company commander wasn't there, they wouldn't actually tell me that I was going to be the second platoon leader,
mm-hmm.
because the weapons platoon didn't have a platoon leader at the time either, and of course they didn't want to, you know. But and Sergeant Wright figured I was going to be his platoon leader, and he was pretty good, you know, kind of nice, but just waiting to see what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next morning, so I'm kind of walking, I'm just out for the walk, you know. I'm not really in charge of anything, but we're leaving the hill, so I'm going with them. And they told me, and then we had Doug Falk, who'd been in country at that time. He'd come over with the brigade, but he was still a second lieutenant. He graduated from OCS. And he was the XO. He'd been the third platoon leader up until the month before, and then they'd moved him and made him an executive officer, and he was really good. But it was kind of funny. He was, everybody else was the first lieutenant, and he was a second lieutenant, and he'd been there the longest.
Mm-hmm.
He'd come out of OCS and I think gone to Vietnam 6 weeks after his OCS, and after he graduated from OCS. And so we just marched, you know, we walked off the hill, and then I had no idea what we were doing. You know, it was dark, and I got in line. I wasn't in line with the right platoon because everybody was just marching past you, and I was asking questions, and nobody's saying nothing. They're just
mm-hmm.
leaving, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I finally decided I better get in line or I'm going to be in trouble. And we marched down the hill through this village, and then I fell off, and here's the long answer to your question, I guess. I fell off a rice paddy as we're moving out across the rice paddy. And I'm flopping around there, and I got this big pack on that I wasn't used to wearing and stuff. And I'm having a hard time, and every time I go to get up, you know, the paddy dike's wet, you know, and my boots are wet, and I keep falling back in.
Right.
And everybody just keeps walking past me, right?
Uh-huh.
And I finally hear out of the darkness, and somebody said, "Who the hell is that making all the noise?" One of the other guys says, "Well, it's that fucking new lieutenant, I guess." and they're just walking on, and finally somebody at the end of the line helped me out. So then I'm all the way to the end. So you know, I mean, that was pretty much your attitude when you're new and nobody knew you, you know. So then I ended up being with the platoon, and we were on a blocking force and stopping people. Two of the other companies were pushing into us, and we were working with some PRUs. I don't know if you probably heard about the PRUs.
Oh, yes.
We had some national police and some PRUs with us, and they were interrogating these people.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were picking them up and sending them up to this collection point. And then they were kind of talking to them and sending some of them on and then tying some of them up, you know, tying their hands behind their back and having them squat over off to the side. And where I was originally, I couldn't see that, but I got called up to the CP after they finished interrogating all these people. We were just sending people up that way. So Enters called me up there, and I get up there, and they're just beating the hell out of these people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just really, it was, the technique was really interesting. I'm thinking, I asked him, I said, well, what are we letting them do that for? And he said, no, that's their operation. We're not allowed to interfere with that.
Hmm.
And they had this E7 MP that was the advisor, and he's down there up there with us, and they're just beating these people with sticks that are probably as big around as your thumb and yelling at them. There'll be two or three people running around, one of them walking around, one of them they've got squatting and beating them. And then they finally end up with one kid they thought was a draft dodger, and they took him off, and he was all beaten up. And a fellow that said he was a sniper in the Viet Cong, and he was supposed to go and show us his hole. And then they had a woman that said she was a squad leader of a Viet Cong squad.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd actually called her up with the telephone, and I don't know if you ever, I don't know. But anyway, they'd taken a field phone, which is a DC current, and
uh-huh.
it actually puts out a lot of voltage or wattage, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd actually had some wires with alligator clips on them and fastened them to the woman and then would crank the phone up and interrogate her.
Where were they fastened to?
They were fastened to her genitals or to her breast. So finally she breaks down and says, okay, she'll take us to where they're going. So Enters in the two platoons. He sends the second platoon, which was the platoon I wasn't really assigned to but was with,
mm-hmm.
Doug Falk, who had the most experience, and he said he'd go with them, and Enters and Brad Burgraff, the other two platoon leaders, took the rest of the company to make a remain overnight, you know, a night defensive position, and sent us with the national police to check out to see if there was anything to this story.
Mm-hmm.
And we marched around, and later on the sniper shows him his hole, and there's no weapon, and one of the PRUs just shot him.
Wow. Right there in front of you.
Yeah, well, I didn't see. I heard the shot,
mm-hmm.
and I'm all nervous, and nobody else is moving around. I was further back in the line.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody else starts doing anything because it was one shot and it was a .45.
Mm-hmm.
And they all recognized the noise. And all I realized was it had been a shot. And, of course, I'm all excited. And they said, oh, don't worry about it. So we get up there, and here's this guy laying there. And I asked Enters, I mean, to Doug Falk, I said, what happened? And he said, well, they got mad and shot him. And he's arguing with this E7. And the E7's telling him not to worry about it. It's none of our business. And so we go up and then surround this little village, and they start... it was a hamlet, you know, maybe five or six huts. And they start searching the hamlet, and eventually they dig up, can't find anything, so they start phoning this woman up again with the TA-312, and she tells them where to look, and they move this wood pile, and there's a trap door under it, and the sergeant pulls up the trap door, and a grenade comes flying out.
Oh,
and,
boy.
And I'm sitting back there wanting, you know, I'm just got my mouth open, you know.
Right.
And the PRUs and the National Police drop back about two rice paddies and punt it. You know, they just start opening up on full automatic, and we're between them and the VC, and there's turned out there was five VCs in these tunnels down there, and they're popping up and shooting, and so we get into this little firefight, and last probably 30 minutes once we've got the PRUs to quit firing. And
were you actually firing yourself?
Actually, no. I didn't fire that first time because I wasn't in charge of anybody, and I was just watching the trail, helping somebody watch the trail, and Doug Falk was in charge of things, and but I could see everything going on from where I was. You know,
okay.
I could see the whole thing, and I was taking fire. I mean, we were down under. They had an M14E2, and which was the old automatic version of the M14, and they had an M16, and an AK-47, and a couple of. Yeah, anyway, we captured. They were all armed anyway, and so. Took about 30 minutes, and they finally got them cleaned out. And we had one fellow took a little piece of shrapnel, probably from an M79, and got dusted off. And then the PRU interrogator, who was a young guy and was the one that was doing the really major part of the physical torture or interrogation on these people, took a little piece of shrapnel in his jaw, and every time he'd see his blood, he'd pass out. It was kind of ironic, I thought. And so they dusted him off, and then we set up there for the night because it was already getting dark.
And this is your first full day or second full day?
Yeah, this is my first day.
Wow.
Yeah. We walked off the hill at 3:30 in the morning, and so I thought, and my thought at the end, I felt like I'd been on the 6 o'clock news. You know, everything you'd ever heard about. You know, I'd seen these South Vietnamese kind of torturing people. I'd seen, you know, been this execution, and then then we'd been in this firefight, and I thought, well, this is just bizarre. You know,
right.
And I don't know what I expected. I don't know if I expected to, but. But I hadn't expected the first two things for sure.
Yes, sir.
And
why don't we go ahead and take a break for today?
Sure.
Okay.